Welcome to Ouroboros Podcast, episode number 189. I am your host, Colin, coming to you from Bath. So I took another week off last week. It was another case of not having anything to talk about, and my whole time management being thrown out of whack by the fact that the Tour de France was on. I could have spent most of last week talking about the Tour de France, but I thought people wouldn't appreciate that 2 weeks in a row. But the irony of that is that now the Tour de France is almost over, I pretty much have to talk about it. So this week I will be discussing the last 2 weeks of the Tour de France, which might not make some people happy. Although the biggest critic of me talking about cycling, Stuart Morrison from the Insomnia Radio UK podcast, actually sent me an email this week, and in passing, he did mention that he'd watched a mountain stage of the Tour de France and actually quite enjoyed it. They all get converted eventually. And on that front, I also watched a film this week, well, documentary this week, called Chasing Legends, which followed Mark Cavendish's Columbia HTC team through the 2009 Tour de France. That is a brilliant documentary. And for anybody who is interested in cycling and wants to understand why I find cycling so exciting, that is a brilliant documentary to watch because it pretty much encapsulates everything that I love about the sport of cycling. So that's a definite recommendation for anybody who's vaguely interested in cycling, the documentary Chasing Legends. And the other film I saw this week was a trip to the cinema. I saw what is perhaps the most art house film I have ever seen. And there's lots to discuss on that, so that's the other subject of conversation for today. But before all that, we've got some music, and here's the first track. Here's another play for Aromahue. This is Obscurity.
Have you ever found the time to know for sure that you are living your full life in every second? Have you ever found the time to feel so proud even of your smallest things that you did in the past? You're wasting your
disagree, you'll never lie to me. I wanna go.
Hugh come from Świebodzin in Poland, and that's another track from their Closer EP. And I do really like their sound, really nice blend of trip-hop and rock influences. Very cool stuff. So, as promised, it's time to have a review of the last couple of weeks in the Tour de France.
Offensive foul, number 54, Colin G. Talking about sports on a music podcast. 10-yard penalty, first down.
The first thing that needs to be discussed is an incident that happened Sunday 2 weeks ago, the day after the last podcast was released. It was one of the worst crashes I've ever seen. Not particularly for any injuries that happened to it. There have been plenty of crashes that have caused major injury and have been hard to watch. But it wasn't so much the crash itself as what caused it. Because in the day's breakaway on stage 9, the breakaway was hit by a car. Now, surrounding the Tour de France, there are always cars, there are always motorbikes. For various reasons. I mean, you have cars with the race officials in it, you have cars for each of the teams to hand out bottles and new wheels and so forth. You have cars with VIPs in them. You have photographers on motorbikes. You have cameramen on motorbikes. The peloton is always surrounded by motor vehicles. Yet, they never interfere, or almost never interfere. But in this case, two riders were wiped out by a car that was part of the French TV fleet and probably had VIP visitors in it. Now, what happened was that this VIP car was overtaking the breakaway, and it later emerged that they didn't have permission from the referees to overtake the breakaway. And as it was overtaking, it realised it was about to hit a tree. So instead of doing the sensible, logical thing of braking and simply letting the four riders who were right next to it go past, it instead decided to steer around the tree and therefore managed to hit Juan Antonio Fletcher, who is at that point at the head of the four-man breakaway. He, of course, careened off in the opposite direction and managed to wipe out Johnny Hoogeland, who was right behind him. Fletcher hit the ground at a great speed, and Hoogeland was flipped off over a ditch and into a barbed wire fence, from which he had to have 33 stitches in his legs and backside. I mean, Johnny Hoogeland became an instant folk hero, because on this particular stage he'd accrued enough points in the King of the Mountains competition to be given that jersey at the end of the stage. But of course you don't get the jersey if you don't finish the stage. So despite having his shorts completely ripped off him by barbed wire, despite bleeding profusely from both legs, he had to finish the stage, and in fact did. And it was one of the most moving jersey presentations I've ever seen, because Johnny Hoogeland went up there, obviously in great pain, took his polka dot jersey for King of the Mountains, crying his eyes out, because he knew A, he'd really earned it, and B, because of his injuries, he probably wouldn't be able to defend it. In fact, there was some talk that he would have to withdraw because of his injuries. And it was just fortunate that the next day happened to be the rest day. So he managed to recover enough and has managed to limp through. And at time of recording is still in the race, although way, way down. He's long ago lost his polka dot jersey. So that was quite extraordinary. But another man in that breakaway has become the story of the second 2 weeks of the tour. And that's Thomas Voerkle, who only just managed to avoid being hit by Juan Antonio Fletcher, who had been hit by this car. He stayed upright and kept on riding. And at the end of the stage, he and the other man in this four-man breakaway, Luis Leon Sanchez, crossed the line well ahead of the peloton. While Sanchez won the stage, Thomas Voerkle got the yellow jersey. And since Thomas Voerkle got the yellow jersey at the end of stage 9, he has proceeded to do a Pereiro. Now, cycling fans will know exactly what I mean when I say that, but for the rest of you, i.e. the majority of you, I think I'm going to have to explain that. This is a term I've come up with myself, and it refers back to the 2006 Tour de France, where Oscar Pereiro managed to win the Tour de France after getting into a breakaway. Now, he is by far the weakest Tour de France winner of the last 20, even 30 years. Oscar Pereiro was never a really, really top rider. He was always the kind of super domestique, the ideal teammate that would do a massive amount of work to help somebody else to win. But in 2006, a series of circumstances happened that allowed Oscar Pereiro to win the Tour de France. And apart from this victory in the greatest cycling race on the calendar, the only victories that Oscar Pereiro ever achieved in his whole career was one stage of the Tour de Suisse and one stage of the Tour of Romandy. So he was never a top, top level cyclist. But on stage 12 of the 2006 Tour de France, the breakaway that he was in at the time was just allowed to go, and he crossed the line 29 minutes and 57 seconds ahead of the peloton. And that is a massive difference. At the absolute maximum in the modern cycling peloton, the breakaway would get 10 minutes. Absolute maximum. And it's more often than not between 3 and 5 minutes ahead of the peloton when they allow the breakaway to succeed. So to give somebody half an hour in a breakaway was unprecedented and, as it turned out, deeply, deeply stupid. I mean, there are reasons for doing this, because it's expected that the team of the rider who's got the yellow jersey is expected to do all the work at the front of the peloton and chase down the breakaways and keep tempo. So occasionally, a major contender will give somebody the yellow jersey on a different team so they don't have to do the work for the next few days, knowing that this person in the breakaway isn't going to be strong enough to hold the jersey once they get into the mountains. The stupid thing in 2006 was that we only had the Alps to go, as there was going to be fewer chances for the contenders to get the jersey back. I mean, this scenario of giving a non-contender the jersey before the big mountain stages happened to the aforementioned Thomas Voerkler back in 2004. He became a national hero in France when he held the yellow jersey for 11 days when Lance Armstrong basically allowed a breakaway he was in to succeed. Voerkler did in fact get through the Pyrenees and held the jersey by 22 seconds until they got to the Alps and Armstrong took it back. So this kind of thing does happen when a complete non-contender is given the yellow jersey for a few days in order to give the contender's team a rest. But giving Oscar Pereiro half an hour was a really, really bad move. Because although he wasn't one of the top, top contenders, he was good enough that it was risky giving him half an hour. And as it turned out, he eventually did win the 2006 Tour de France, only after Floyd Landis failed a dope test. So when I say doing a Pereiro, I mean giving somebody the yellow jersey in a breakaway who accidentally turns into a serious contender for the Tour de France. And that's what's happened to Thomas Voerkler. As I said, in stage 9, he was in this four-man breakaway. The breakaway succeeded. In this case, mainly because there was a pretty big crash on one of the descents behind them, which took out the top Belgian rider, Jürgen Vandenbroek, and the top Kazakh rider, Alexander Vinokourov. So, while the peloton waited to see if those two could get back on their bikes and continue. I mean, because it's a gentleman's agreement that if somebody crashes, the peloton slows down and sees if they can continue. So while this was happening, the breakaway with Voerkler and Sanchez in it was allowed to get a bit more time. Eventually, Sanchez and Voerkler crossed the line 3 minutes 59 seconds ahead of the peloton. So, you know, a traditional kind of thing, giving the jersey to a non-contender by not a very big margin, knowing that he'll give it up in the mountains. Well, they should have learnt the lessons from 2004, when on the Plateau de Baie, Voerkler kept the yellow jersey by 22 seconds from Armstrong. I mean, since 2004, Voerkler has been French champion twice, and has won numerous one-day races as well. He's by far France's best rider. He's just not a contender for the Tour de France. And as it turns out, he was a little bit too good to be given the yellow jersey. On three or four stages, it was a case of, oh, this will be the day when Voerkler finally loses the yellow jersey. It's an uphill finish. He can't possibly succeed. But he kept it. For 10 days, he kept the yellow jersey and just cemented his place as France's favourite cyclist. And I have to say, the world's favourite cyclist, because it's always entertaining watching Thomas Voerkler. He's a very attacking, aggressive rider. So this brings us to the stage yesterday as I'm recording, i.e. Thursday, which finished on the Col du Galibier. It was a mountaintop finish, and in fact is the highest ever finishing point for a stage of the Tour de France. There has never been a higher stage finished in the 108 years that the Tour de France has been competed. At the start of the day, Voerkler is in the yellow jersey. He's got a narrow lead over the big contenders, the Schleck brothers, Frank and Andy, and Cadell Evans. By this time, Alberto Contador is not really a contender because he got involved in a small crash earlier in the week and lost a minute and 20 seconds on his rivals. And he hasn't looked in good form, so he's not really considered a contender anymore. We've got Werkler in front and not expected to keep the yellow jersey, the Schleck brothers and Evans behind him as the real contenders for this year's tour. There are three mountains on this stage. The Col de Galibier, which is the finishing point, the Col d'Izoard and the Col d'Agnel, all three of which are iconic alpine climbs. They put in this stage in the Tour de France this year to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Tour de France first going into the Alps. So they put in this massive day in the mountains. All three of these mountains are outside classification. They are the steepest, the tallest mountains that the Tour de France goes up. 60 kilometres from the finish on the Col d'Izoard, Andy Schleck attacks. And in the modern peloton, that is something that never ever happens. You always save your big attack for the last big mountain of the day, because there's only so much energy you can give and still be successful. So to do it 60 kilometres from the finish on the second of three really big climbs was monumentally risky. As it happened, I said to myself, this is either going to be a brave, bold, potentially tour-winning move by Andy Schleck, or another example of how tactically naive he is. Because the risk of fading on the final climb was just so great that it seems like a massive, massive gamble. But as it happened, it paid off. He won the stage and leapt up the standings. But he didn't take the yellow jersey. Despite being an average climber at best, Thomas Voeckler held the yellow jersey by 15 seconds. And it was just one of the bravest rides I've ever seen in my life. He pretty much collapsed as soon as he got over the line. He had to be helped off his bike by his teammates, but he held the yellow jersey for one more day by 15 seconds. And another interesting thing that happened was that Alberto Contador lost time on everybody else. There was a big attack on the Col du Galibier to try and catch Andy Schleck, and Contador couldn't keep with it. So it's even more of a certainty that Contador won't win this year's Tour de France. So to make up for it, on today's stage, Friday's stage, to Alpe d'Huez, which is the iconic climb in the Alps, Alberto Contador tried to do the same thing as Andy Schleck. He tried to go on the first big climb of the day rather than the last. And this time it didn't work. Which again goes to show how impressive Andy Schleck's performance was on Thursday. Because Alberto Contador couldn't do the same thing. He attacked on the first climb of the day, the Col du Telegraph, But by the time he'd reached the foot of the Alpe d'Huez, the main contenders were all together with him. Apart from, unfortunately, Thomas Voerkler, it was just one mountain stage too far for him, and he'd cracked earlier in the day. So all the major contenders, Contador, Andy Schleck, Frank Schleck, Cadel Evans, Samuel Sanchez, they were all in the group at the foot of L'Alpe d'Huez. And nobody could get any real time on anybody else. Nobody really cracked. I mean, Contador did get a little bit of time, but he was already so far behind that he's still not a real contender. So it's basically as we were. Tomorrow, or today as this is released, Saturday, is the time trial. And that will decide who wins the Tour de France. Andy Schleck is in yellow today because Voerkler lost time. Although Voerkler is still in fourth. He's got Frank Schleck, his brother, in second place at 53 seconds. And Cadel Evans in third place at 57 seconds. And since Evans is a much, much better time trialer than either of the Schleck brothers, it seems very likely that Cadel Evans will finally win the Tour de France after finishing second twice. So that's the Tour de France, and by the time this podcast is released, it'll probably have been decided. And I think my money's on Cadel Evans. Although, as he pointed out in an interview I saw on the TV coverage, he's been in the same situation twice and has failed both times. So we're going to have to see. But personally, I'd like Evans to win because this is pretty much his last chance. In fact, I thought he'd already had his last chance. So the fact that he's this close again, I'd really like him to win. I mean, and Andy Schleck's 24 years old, so he'll have plenty more opportunities. And of course, there's every chance that he'll be given last year's Tour de France if Contador gets banned for drugs. He might already be a Tour de France winner, we just don't know. So, I'd like Evans to win, and I think he probably will win. And I guess that's it, and it's been far too much cycling talk, even if Stuart Morrison seems to be a bit more accepting of it than he has been in the past. The next track I've got for you is by Chicago band Young Jesus. Got a really nice indie rock sound, and their EP Young, Innocent and Hairy, which is quite a cool title, is available free from their website, which is whoisyoungjesus.com. Here's a really great track off that EP. It's called Eloise at the Plaza.
She's been riding by Chicago, shrugging off the suburbs with a frown. She says city kids look smoother in the moonlight. Yeah, city kids drink past 2 a.m. But Eloise looks weird under the moonlight.
Stick it to the man. It was called rock and roll. But guess what? Oh no! The man ruined that too with a little thing called MTV!
I've been planning my spontaneous combustion for quite some time. Has anybody got a light? I've been planning my spontaneous combustion for quite some time. Has anybody got a light? I lost my faith to smoke and mirrors, and the only voice inside my head was the one that told me love is dead.
Thank you.
And that was Jack by Hermes, who come from Cirencester in Gloucestershire. And that's the other half of the double A-side single they released recently with No Age for Saints, which I played a few weeks ago. Bit more down-tempo and low-key than No Age for Saints, but still a really nice track. So it's been a while since I did a full film review, but I saw something at the cinema this week that really, really needs discussion. The word auteur does get a bit overused when it comes to film directors, but one person who I think definitely deserves the term auteur is Terrence Malick. He is very well received critically, but has only made 5 films in the last 28 years. His directorial debut was Badlands, which is an awesome film, and I think one of the best things that Martin Sheen has ever done as an actor. But most people will probably know his name from his film The Thin Red Line, which was released in 1998. Well, his latest effort is called The Tree of Life. And as I said in my intro, it's possibly the most art house film I have ever seen. The basic concept for this film is so monumentally ambitious that it's difficult to know whether it's been achieved. It's one of those films that each individual person who sees it is going to take something completely different from their experience. Malick is trying to link the birth or the existence of the universe to the story of a family living in the 50s. Now, this sounds like a bizarre concept, and in a lot of ways it's a bizarre film. The way he does this is to have lots of imagery of the universe. It's almost like a Discovery Channel documentary in a lot of ways. There's lots of sweeping views of the universe, of planets, of stars, of galaxies being born. And there's also an extended period where dinosaurs show up. And really, really good CGI dinosaurs, you know, to the level of Walking with Dinosaurs, if not better. And this is just stuck in the middle of this film. To the extent that one of the people I was seeing this film with at the cinema actually went out to the staff outside and said, "You've put the wrong film on." Until he came back in after being told, "Actually, yes, there are dinosaurs in this film." It's that kind of experience. I mean, I would struggle even to call it a film. It is so non-traditionally structured and written that all the conventions and expectations of what a cinema experience or a film experience is are just thrown out of the window. I mean, we have a discussion of this family in the 50s. And all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, it's intercut with a picture of a waterfall. And there are lots of motifs that keep on happening. I mean, we have something fairly ordinary going on, and it's intercut with lots of images of water. I mean, this image of the waterfall recurs a lot, and lots of other imagery of water continues. I mean, like rain and thunderstorms and rolling waves. And there's also a recurring motif of trees. This one tree in the garden of this house in the 50s keeps on being recalled, and other trees keep on intercutting into the film. I mean, that's an expected motif, perhaps, given that the film is called Tree of Life. All of this is beautiful. It is an absolutely beautiful film. But I'm not sure it makes any sense. But again, I think different people will have different experiences of this film. So I'm not saying you shouldn't go and see it. In fact, I'm saying you should see it, and preferably at the cinema, because you might get something out of it, but equally, you might not. And personally speaking, I didn't get it. While it's beautiful, it truly is beautiful. I mean, the cinematography is wonderful. The CGI of the dinosaurs in the universe is wonderful. Although there is a little bit too much religious overlay into the story of the universe for me, but that's just personal. I mean, he does seem to be linking the universe and the existence of the universe to some form of God. But it's so unusually structured and edited that it is a bit of a trial to get through. Editing is something that you don't really notice until it's done so differently that you are made aware of how we, as a film viewing audience, have been indoctrinated into the way that films are traditionally edited. The way Malick seems to do it is he just shoots everything. There is a figure out there that for every hour of footage he shot for this film, he used 2 minutes. And that's just extraordinary. But it does mean that he can use this unusual technique. I mean, what Malick does is he just uses a shot until he's bored with it, and then uses a different shot. And where in a traditional film you would have a different angle or a different focus between the two edits, in this case, it could be the same shot, it's just two different takes, and the action has gone on a little bit further. Now, I might be making this seem like it's a confusing film, but that's not the case at all. You can more or less get the impression of where he's going. It's just, it's presented to you as a viewing audience in a very, very different way. All this stuff about the birth of the universe and the existence of the universe is intertwined with this story of a family in the 50s with a very controlling, borderline abusive father played by Brad Pitt. And this story is fascinating, and what we're shown of this family and the attitudes of people in the 50s is very powerful. But at the same time, it's kind of frustrating, because what Malick is trying to present to us is not the story of this family. As I've said, it's the story of the universe, or what he thinks is the story of the universe. So while this family relationship, I mean, particularly between the father and his eldest son, played brilliantly by a young actor named Hunter McCracken, who doesn't appear to have done any other acting, but he is brilliant in the film. This relationship between Brad Pitt and his son would in any other film be the core of the film. But here it isn't, and that's what's frustrating. If Malick had made a film just about this family relationship, for my money, it would have been a better film, because the interplay between Brad Pitt and his wife and his three sons was extraordinary and tells a story of that era and the attitudes that were prevalent in that era. And when you add in all the other stuff, it kind of dilutes that story and that message. And then you add in the other big name in this film, Sean Penn, who plays Brad Pitt's eldest son as a grown-up in the modern day. He has pretty much nothing to do in this film. There doesn't seem to be any purpose for the grown-up Jack to be in the film. Again, in any other story, it would have been about the redemption of his relationship with his father, who we see on the phone, but we don't see in real life, so to speak. So Sean Penn pretty much has nothing to do, except one last scene, where in kind of an artistic and art house way, he goes through a door in a desert and ends up on a beach where all the people have been in the film, all the dead people have been in the film, including his younger brother who dies. It's implied that he died in Vietnam, but that's never fully established. So all these people are on the beach, including his mother, and he greets them all and hugs them, and the music's beautiful. And it's supposed to be this really powerful scene, and from the reviews I've seen and heard, a lot of people did get a really powerful emotional reaction to this. But for me, it did come a bit out of nowhere and has very little relationship to the rest of the film. And that's probably what Malick was going for, even though I like arthouse cinema and like challenging films. It was a step too far for me. Part of the problem might have been that I was slightly sleep deprived when I saw this, so I might have had a micro sleep at a crucial point. But this is the kind of film where I can't say for sure, because it's just as likely that I didn't miss anything and Malick just went there anyway. So the bottom line for Tree of Life is I didn't like it too much, but I'm really glad I saw it. It is a beautiful film, but don't expect it to be traditional. Don't expect the conventions you don't necessarily notice in modern filmmaking to be observed. For me, it might have been better if they'd focused fully on the father-son relationship, but the fact they didn't shows that Malick was going for something completely different. And whether he achieved it or not is purely up to the person watching it. And that's my review of Tree of Life by Terrence Malick. So on to the next bit of music. And here's a welcome return to the show for Echo Lounge from Cardiff in South Wales with their track Network, which uses a sample from the classic film from the 70s, which is kind of awesome. But the track itself is kind of awesome, and it comes off Echo Lounge's last EP, Human Machine. So from Cardiff, this is Echo Lounge with their track Network.
Kogel from Made in the UK.
This is the Grumbler from Made in the UK.
This is Colin from Made in the UK.
I'm Gobble from Made in the UK.
And this is Rowley, Made in the UK. Made in the UK
for the world.
Oh, isn't he bold?
We'll be right back.
And that was Eyes by Neon Legion, which is basically Philipp Kurt Cressin, who was born in Germany, spent a lot of his youth in Argentina, but now splits his time between Toronto and New York. So a very cosmopolitan person, I guess. And rather cool music. That track, Eyes, comes off Neon Legion's album called Empire. So, a bit of an update on my personal situation. A couple of episodes ago, I said that I had an interview for a college course at my local college for a music technology course. Well, last week I got confirmation that I'd been rejected for that course, which was a bit disappointing but not entirely unexpected, because what I'm interested in is sound engineering and music production rather than creating my own music, and the focus of this course was definitely for people who wanted to make music themselves, which is not something I've ever had a real desire to do. But I was given the impression that it was still worth applying for the course, so I did. And obviously it was oversubscribed and I was the first name off the list. So that's rather disappointing, but I am gonna investigate a more appropriate college course and see if there's anywhere nearby that offers it. I mean, I've been told that Bridgewater College in Somerset might do this course, but that's about 50 miles away, so I'm going to have to see if there's anything a bit closer. So that's disappointing, and it's too late to do anything about it this year, but next spring I will be trying to get onto a more appropriate course. But until then, I guess the search for a job goes on. And due to my sleep patterns being completely screwed up by watching hours and hours of Tour de France every day, I've had a lot of opportunity to listen to podcasts. So I can now proudly state that I am less than a year behind on all my music podcasts. I've been listening to year-old episodes of the Bugcast and This Reality Podcast and Dark Compass for the past couple of weeks. And I might actually be inspired to send some feedback to the Bugcast for episodes that they broadcast over a year ago. So that might be interesting. And speaking of the Bugcast,
Weird Trend of the Week.
This week's artist I last played about 2 years ago. They're called X-Bloom and come from Vienna in Austria. And they've released a new album under a Creative Commons license from their website. It's called X Marks the Spot. And it's a little bit more traditional than their first album, but I still think it's a little bit off-kilter and still qualifies as a weird track of the week. So, yeah. Nice, weird electronic music from Austria. So here is X-Bloom with Depends on the Situation. See you next time, and remember, good music is infinite.
Listening to Colin and the Ouroboros podcast. Good music is infinite.